This Labor Day, say goodbye to spills, stains, and overpriced furniture with WashableSofas.com. Featuring Anabay, the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly pricing. Sofas start at just $6.99, making it the perfect time to upgrade your space. Anabay's pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and interchangeable slipcovers are made with high-performance fabric built for real life. You'll love the cloud-like comfort of hypoallergenic, high-resilience foam that never needs fluffing, and a durable steel frame that stands the test of time. With modular pieces, you can rearrange anytime. It's a sofa that adapts to your life. Now through Labor Day, get up to 60% off site-wide at WashableSofas.com. Every order comes with a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping, no restocking fees, every penny back. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Elon Musk of Tesla, Elon Musk of SpaceX, especially of SpaceX and Starship, Elon Musk of the Boring Company, to tunnel underneath Los Angeles and other constituencies that are overwhelmed with traffic, and Elon Musk of Twitter. I welcome Richard Epstein, Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, a senior fellow. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, writing most recently of Elon Musk, who makes news all the time, but we're focusing now on Elon Musk, who has said he will be a temporary Twitter CEO. The summary of what's happened since Elon Musk first spoke up about buying Twitter is that it remains controversial politically. And Richard is doing us the favor of taking us to the part of the law where the question of Twitter as a public organization like the telephone company or a private organization like a publisher matters a deal. Richard, a very good evening to you. The debate is government and Twitter and the relationship. Beforehand, the presumption was that Twitter was enforcing what were understood to be filters for disinformation not to reach the public, especially about the virus. But now everything is debated because Elon Musk, which is not a technical term, he just presents himself as a man who is characterized best as a First Amendment absolutist. What does that mean? What can you discern about that for Elon Musk? And why is that now at risk in the comments by political leaders? Good evening to you, Richard.
Yeah, good. The word absolutism is both an intriguing and dangerous word. What it means is that one particular value is so strong that there's nothing else that you could put on the table that will dissuade you from keeping to that particular value. So it's a situation where there are rival considerations. You know in advance which one is going to win. It turns out in many cases, absolutism is a very safe guy. That is, if you want to talk about ordinary political speech and somebody says he's a First Amendment absolutist, he's not going to stop debate. But if you say you're a First Amendment absolutist over everything, then, well, suppose somebody comes up to you, John, and says your money or your life. Well, that's a form of speech. Are we supposed to say it's absolutely protected, notwithstanding the fact that everybody would regard it as a threat for extortion? And you can go through the list of criminal offenses, and for every physical offense you find, you could always find yourself one that has to do with the use of words. Extortion, menacing, fraud, misrepresentation, defamation, breach of privacy, and all the rest of that stuff, forming a conspiracy, all involve expressive behavior. And so the absolutist would have to say, we're not going to do anything in order to regulate that stuff. We're going to make everything having to do with speech a free fire zone. Nobody really believes that. So then the question is exactly what are the kinds of limitations that you want to put on speech? And here the basic intuition that one has is our American constitutional system tends to regard speech as a preferred freedom. And the theory being quite simply that rapid exchange of ideas is something which is extraordinarily important to get political deliberation on matters which are extremely important. And if you don't get the deliberation, you won't come out with the right sort of result. And so essentially what happens now is in this particular domain, you want to protect it. But everywhere else, it may well be that you have to be able to strike it down. So we have a higher level of scrutiny. And it turns out the moment you increase the level of scrutiny in any of these areas, everybody becomes some kind of a closet libertarian. So you want to say, well, why can we stop speech? Well, it's not because you disagree with it, but if you're threatening force or if you're using fraud, or if you're trying to form monopolies, those are the kinds of speech that we're going to go after. And force, fraud, and monopoly are the three things that classical liberals seek most to attack in an effort to preserve a free society. So when you're looking at Moss, the question is, how does he think about those things? We don't know. But on the other hand, the stuff that he's attacking, i.e. stuff having to do with quote-unquote disinformation or misinformation, the definition of misinformation or disinformation by Twitter is stuff which may well be true, but it's presented by people who we don't like. And so you take the New York Post off of the airwaves or off of the Twitter situation because of what it says about Hunter Biden's laptop. And you get a bunch of experts to say, ah, this is clearly Soviet disinformation. We have to push it down. Well, it turns out it's not Soviet disinformation. So when you have an organization like Twitter that makes judgments on these kinds of political issues, they often get them wrong. And this is an important enough situation because it easily could have influenced the outcome of the 2020 election, for it was known that Joe Biden was running with a son who was deeply involved with all sorts of nefarious characters and may have actually tried to help his father with these kinds of connections. It would have influenced voters. And on the COVID situation, we know that anything that it turns out is not agreed to by the CDC or the World Health Organization is going to be regarded as misinformation. I spent a lot of time trying to review this stuff. And as far as I can tell, the CDC is never right. And the WHO is not quite behind. And there are all sorts of technical questions here. And you get a bunch of eminent scientists, and their Twitter says that they are simply not fit for public consumption because they question the effectiveness of a vaccine, even though it seems to be failing today in two ways. One, there are a lot of breakthrough cases, so it doesn't seem to protect anybody. And two, it seems that there are a large number of cases of adverse side effects ranging from everything up and down the line. Myocarditis, which is a heart condition, interference with menstrual cycles, Guillain-Barré syndrome. There's a list of 20 conditions that have been associated with by some. True or false? Cannot say authoritatively. But what's one thing is clear, if you use the term disinformation to take eminent authorities and keep them off of your network, you're doing something that's very wrong. And this is the good thing about, I think, Moss. When he says he's going after these guys, he is not trying to hide behind the particularist notion that, well, I'm a private company, I can do what I want. He's a private company, he can do what he wants. That means he could also let all these things start to go. And that's what frightens the American left. They think that if he takes over, the stuff that they want to keep throttled down under disinformation may become public, and they'll have to start answering some questions. And that's why, notwithstanding his conceptual mistake, in the short term, the effort of Trump, of Musk to take over this particular network will, in my view, produce in general positive benefits.
There is law, UF 47 U.S. Code 230, protection for private blocking and screening of offensive material. It's very detailed. Section 230 is what we're looking at of the Community Decency Act. Question is, does it need to be revised again? It's been revised several times since the late 20th century, most recently, I believe, in 2018. Is it adequate to this debate, Richard?
No. At present, it seems to me that the way in which this thing is worked is too broad. First of all, the line, as you mentioned earlier in the show, between somebody who is a publisher of material and somebody who simply offers a platform on which material appears seems to be getting thinner by the day. Because every time you decide that there's somebody whose stuff you don't like, you're doing it for reasons of content. And that kind of looks very much like an editorial judgment. And so to say, in effect, that Twitter should get a complete immunity when it starts to suppress this speech, doing so, by the way, by defaming people, saying to Mr. Malone, you think that you're a great physician and so forth, but we know that you're a fraud. Everything you put on there is crazy. It's really very close to sort of defamation. But the other thing is the words that they start to talk about, this is sort of being objectively offended, otherwise objectionable. That is such a broad level. And if you contrast it with everything else that is put onto the list having to do with immorality and so forth, various kinds of statements having to do with lascivious remarks, pornography, violence and lewd behavior and obscenity, they just don't belong in the same class. There is a legal doctrine known as justem generis, it's a Latin term, which says that you want to have things that are included which are of the same sort of the specific things that are listed. Otherwise objectionable, but it's no relationship to the kind of stuff that they're talking about, violence, filth, lasciviousness. This has to do with genuine disagreements between experts over the question of whether or not a certain proposed treatment is in fact going to be safe. So I would want to just strike those particular words out and certainly not give them any kind of protection under the Community Decency Act for that side of stuff. And yet I certainly think it's perfectly appropriate to run a network in which you take care of all the other things on the list. So it's the otherwise term, which is in many ways the most dangerous one in the English language.
In the Department of Homeland Security, in these last days, there's been reporting, and it seems reliable, that there's underway the creation of a disinformation governance board. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Mr. Mayorkas, in remarks to Congress, did not evidence that he knows in detail about the board or about who is appointed to lead it. So I'm not looking at personalities. I'm looking at this general understanding that the U.S. government needs to protect the American people from disinformation on a carrier like Twitter. It's a puzzle to me because, generally speaking, when you go overseas and look at countries that use their sovereignty to intimidate or suppress journalists and newspapers, that's considered a negative, a very bad thing. But when you come to this country, does it come to it depends when you're challenging something as disinformation?
Yes. I mean, what's happened is there's a complete reversal. If you had this debate 60 or 70 years ago, you'd be worried about people like Senator Joe McCarthy and the way in which he went after people, had loyalty oaths taking after communists and so forth, wanted to say that in order to become a member of a public organization, you had to disavow loyalty to the communism and so forth. Right. Today, it's kind of the left that's doing all that stuff. If you want to get on the air, you have to have all the right kind of progressive values. And if you wish to dissent from them, then, well, it turns out it's disinformation. There's an old Roman saying, quis custodiet custodiis, who guards the guardians? And what it simply means is if you're putting somebody up in order to protect the state from various kinds of statement, you may not know whether or not the guys who are the guardians are more dangerous than the people who have been guarded. And when you start to think about these kinds of organization, you just say, oh, we're against disinformation. So that means we're going to get another rerun of the situation that we have with Hunter Biden and the paper, because this is going to be now a Biden administration and they're going to say that. And you just get it just absolutely frightening. The usual rule that we have had, and it's a very good rule, is if you think that there's something stated at that level, which is generally false, what happens is then you have counter speech in order to try to expose the error and to explain why it turns out it's a mistake. So if you're talking about the virus, what somebody can say is, oh, you basically got these cases wrong. It wasn't the coronavirus that did this. It was something else. And here's the situation of what the explanation is. And then somebody comes back and you make the argument on the other side. The point is counter speech is completely decentralized, which means that there's no one who has a monopoly over that market. The moment you've got a disinformation bureau, you become very Orwellian. Because you're now saying, we know in advance that there's one side which is right, and it's going to be anointed. And then what always happens under circumstances like that is you announce a board that's supposed to be completely neutral, and you end up appointing to those kinds of boards people that are completely partisan on one side or another. This is not the kind of case with an arbitration where you get neutral arbitrators appointed by the two parties together. This is a case in which everything is going to be in the hands of one party, on the dominant party. This then gives rise to a further problem. And we see this all the time. It's the question of what happens when you start to change administrations. One of the things that the Biden administration has done, which I'm actually involved with against them on litigation, is every time there's an advisory committee that says something they don't like, what they do is they fire all of its members who were appointed by Donald Trump. And this is exactly the same kind of authoritarian behavior that you're witnessing in this particular case. You get somebody, these boards are supposed to be independent, meaning they have to divide an opinion and you have to deal with them. And then what you say is, well, the only people I want on these boards are people who already agree with me, which means that you're completely disturbing their point. The theory is in government, you want to build up institutions in which it turns out honest disagreements of opinion can be spoken without fear of dismissal. And now you're stopping that. And they're going to do exactly the same here. So what happens is this is an argument for monopoly power, when what we really need is to get some form of this of decentralization. My view is that this board is per se unconstitutional as a constant and ominous threat to the freedom of speech. Whether or not you could challenge it facially, i.e. before it does something, is always going to be a tricky question. But the moment it makes its first kind of ruling, I assume there's somebody who's going to be aggrieved by that, who will have a chance to sue and to stop it. Politically, my view is this thing should stop even before it begins, because we do not want to have a president who's authoritarian, whether he's on the right or whether he's on the left. And for all the abuse that Donald Trump has received, he has never once engaged in the kind of activities that Biden is engaged in. He didn't sack people in government advisory positions, and he didn't try to put together a disinformation board.
Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, writing most recently at Defining Ideas for Hoover on the Elon Musk ambition to be the temporary CEO of Twitter as a free speech absolutist, all in quotes. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your social security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This Labor Day, say goodbye to spills, stains, and overpriced furniture with WashableSofas.com. Featuring Anabay, the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly pricing. Sofas start at just $6.99, making it the perfect time to upgrade your space. Anabay's pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and interchangeable slipcovers are made with high-performance fabric built for real life. You'll love the cloud-like comfort of hypoallergenic, high-resilience foam that never needs fluffing, and a durable steel frame that stands the test of time. With modular pieces, you can rearrange anytime. It's a sofa that adapts to your life. Now through Labor Day, get up to 60% off site-wide at WashableSofas.com. Every order comes with a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping, no restocking fees, every penny back. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.